Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bill F., the East Central Regional Trustee, to chair the closing meeting of our 2015 International Convention.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic. I currently have the privilege of serving as the East Central Regional Trustee. Before we start the AA meeting this morning, we have a special presentation. First, I would like to begin by introducing GSO's archivist, Michelle Maraza, to give a presentation on Sister Ignatia. Who, as most of you know, played a significant role in AA's early history. Please help me welcome Michelle.
Many AA members know the importance of Sister Ignatia and the Sisters of Charity Order. How Sister Ignatia and Dr. Bob tended to literally thousands of drunks in the fellowship's early days at St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. Bill W. writes of Sister Ignatia in AA Comes of Age, and I quote, "From this uncertain start of hospitalization, in our pioneering time, we watched the growing procession of alcoholic sufferers as they passed through the doors of St. Thomas and out into the world, most of them never to return to the hospital, except as visitors." And so the ministry of Dr. Bob, his wife Anne, Sister Ignatia, and Akron's early timers set an example for the practice of AA's 12 steps that will remain for all time. End quote. It is estimated that during her career, Sister Ignatia helped tens of thousands of alcoholics. By the time she left Akron in 1952, more than 5,000 alcoholics had received professional medical treatment and counseling services at St. Thomas. She then transferred to Cleveland's St. Vincent's Charity Hospital, where she continued to help rebuild broken lives, founding Rosary Hall, where she helped more than 10,000 clients until her death in 1966. In 1960, before the International Convention in Long Beach, California, Bill W. very much wanted Sister Ignatia to attend. She was not feeling well at the time, but in a letter addressed, "Dear Sister," Bill said, and I quote, "It would be a deep satisfaction to know that you were there and that at least you had seen with your own eyes this great culmination of the work in which you have played such a tremendous part," end quote. In the end, she was able to make the trip to Long Beach and even address the convention, relating the story of her early days with Dr. Bob and how she bootlegged AA's first jittering applicant for admission into the flower room at St. Thomas Hospital. Here then, in her own words, is a recording from that convention. It is like she is with us still.
However, Doctor is so straightforward. I enjoyed working with him. And one day he looked rather down. We often had little chats. And this morning he came in, he looked rather down. I said, Doctor, what's the trouble this morning? Well, then he told me, he said, well, sister, he said, I might as well tell you that I came in contact with a New York broker, and he said, I've had a drinking problem for a long time, and somehow we got together, and we've all tried to work out something that will help these drunks, he said. Well, he said, we've been trying it out. They tried a few rest homes, and he had some in the other hospitals. And he said, sister, would you consider taking one? Well, I hesitated because sometime before, probably some months before, I took a man in who, he looked... I didn't know much about this drinking. I knew some could drink and handle it well, and others couldn't. So they called me to the emergency, and I went down and talked with him. Oh, he said, sister, if I could just lie down a little while. He worked at the city garage and looked like a very respectable person. He said, I've been drinking a little too much, and I want to get straightened out, which I thought was a good thing. Well, the only bed that we had at the time was a bed in a four-bed room. Then we knew nothing about special treatment. And I signed to the man on medical service and registered him, put him to bed, and I said, you won't cause any trouble. Oh, no, he'd be an angel. Well, I forgot about him. When I came over early the next morning, the night supervisor, who was tall sister, we always teased her about her big feet. Well, she was standing at the door waiting for me. She said, the next time you take a DT in this place, please stay up all night and run around after him as we have. That wasn't the end of it either. I decided then that's enough. I often felt sorry to see them turned away, but I was not the last word in the hospital. So when Doctor proposed my taking a real, well, you can imagine my misgivings. I thought, oh, dear me. I told him about this experience, and I said, Doctor, not only will I be put out, but I said, the patient and everything else. I said, I don't think they want alcoholics. He said, sister, this patient won't give you a bit of trouble because I will medicate him, I'll assure you. Well, I had much confidence in him because he never said anything that wasn't so. I'll always say that. Well, very fearfully, I said, well, doctor, I shall take him then. And put him in a two-bedroom. Doctor then came to the admitting office. He said, sister, would you mind putting my patient in a private room? I thought I had done pretty good to put him in a two-bed. He said, you know, there'll be some men come to visit him, and they like to talk to him privately. Well, I said, I'll do what I can, doctor. After he left, I went up and looked the situation over. And right across the hall, we had a flower room where we used to prepare the patient's flowers. And I thought, well, they can fix their flowers somewhere else for today, and I believe I could push the bed in there. That's what we did. and his visitors came. We kept a close eye on them. I did. It was all new. And I thought, well, my, the respectable-looking men, they don't look as though they ever took a drink.
And now I would like to ask the chair of the General Service Board, Terry Bedient, for a very special presentation of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous.
I'm Terry Bedient, a non-alcoholic friend of Alcoholics Anonymous. This morning, it is a great pleasure to have with us Sister Judith Ann Karam, the Congregational Leader of the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine, to which Sister Ignatia belonged. And on this momentous occasion, it is an honor to be able to present this big book to the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine. The first millionth book of AA was presented in 1973, 34 years after publication began, to President Richard Nixon. 5 years later, Joseph Califano, the U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare, obtained the second millionth book from Lois W. In 1988, Ruth Hawk, Bill W.'s first non-alcoholic secretary, presented the fifth millionth book to Nell Wing, the first AA archivist. In 1995, Ellie Norris Wall, widow of former board chair John Norris, was handed the 15 millionth book by Jim Estelle, the chair of the General Service Board. In 2000, Al-Anon family groups received the 20 millionth book. In 2005, at the convention in Toronto, Alan Ault, a Class A trustee, presented the 25th millionth book to San Quentin Prison. San Quentin had been the place of some of AA's earliest meetings behind the walls. In the 2010 convention in San Antonio, former Class A trustee Bill Clark presented the 30th millionth copy to the American Medical Association. Book history is important to AA. In summary, it took 34 years to publish the first million books, and about 1 million big books have been sold each year since then. AA members know from AA's history the importance that the professional community has played, and were it not for our professional friends and supporters, many alcoholics would have continued to suffer, and many would have died. And today, we have asked two very special guests to accept the 35th millionth book of Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book. Please welcome to the stage two sisters who knew Sister Ignatia, from the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine, Sister Judith Ann Karam, F-A-C-H-E, and Sister Teresa Bontempo. Sisters, thank you for being with us here today. AA members very much want to continue to be friendly with our friends in the clergy and in the other professions. On behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous, please accept this 35th millionth book of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous as a token of our appreciation to the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine for the compassionate care provided to alcoholics and our entire fellowship throughout its 80 years of service. Sister Karam.
Thank you so very much, Terry. My name is Sister Judith Ann Karam, and for most of my life, I have been a friend of AA. On behalf of the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine, I thank you for this special gift of the 35th millionth copy of the Big Book, the Holy Ground for Alcoholics Anonymous. Sister Ignatia is perhaps the best known of our sisters, yet she is one of the many strong and courageous women who have devoted their lives to serving others. Though she would have shunned being here, she would have shunned the honors bestowed upon her today. She would have rejoiced in seeing all of you, the fruit of her ministry. She would have given thanks to God for all of you in the AA Fellowship, that the power and grace of God, or whomever you call your higher power, has been at work in the lives of so many of you. Can you imagine if Bill W., Dr. Bob, and Sister Ignatia were standing here now and seeing so many of you in the fellowship that they started? Their community of caring, this community of friends. You are the legacy, present here and in spirit, living and deceased, who have struggled with your demons and are sober, and I honor you. Sister Ignatia belongs to you in a very, very special way. And I quote, "Had someone told me at the crossroads of life," Sister Ignatia said, "at the 10th anniversary of our Rosary Hall, that I'd spend my days caring for alcoholics, I'd have wilted." But God, in his divine providence, works in mysterious ways. We all know that, don't we? He can use very weak and apparently inefficient instruments to accomplish his purpose. End of quote. Sister Ignatia was born Della Gavin in County Mayo, Ireland. Her family eventually came to Cleveland, Ohio. Gifted musically, she gave music lessons in her home. She entered the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine to work with our orphans. That was not God's plan for her. As a sister, she continued teaching music to students until health issues, including a major breakdown, caused her to be hospitalized at the Sisters' new hospital, St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. When recovering, she worked in the admitting office to find places for patients. Some of the patients experienced trauma, broken bones, etc., because they were alcoholics. Thus, she met Dr. Bob, where their partnerships grew in the midst of a strong, mutual, compelling devotion to the alcoholic. One of Dr. Bob's struggles over the next several years was to find an institution to take care of his Elke patients. Dr. Bob, as Bill W. later recounted, and I quote, in desperation, thought of Sister Ignatia, that shy but beaming nun who handled the admissions at the hospital and always focused on the person in front of her and their needs over the hospital policies and procedures. As a hospital administrator, I would call Sister Ignatia, in today's parlance, a high-maintenance person. Sister Ignatia recounts, and I quote, one day Dr. Bob came into the admitting office and seemed rather down. Then he told me about his problem and that he and his New York stockbroker friend couldn't seem to get anyone to take his patients because they were too jittery and disruptive. Recognizing early on alcoholism as a disease and not a social malady, she agreed in August of 1939 to admit his patients with a diagnosis of acute gastritis. Whatever it took. There were talks that she placed the persons brought by Dr. Bob for detoxification and rehab wherever was appropriate. And you know what difficulties she had, including a room for flower delivery at the hospital. Dr. Bob wanted a private room, so she got it for him when no other beds were available. Bill W. returned many times to Akron. He, Dr. Bob, and Sister Ignatia worked together to shape a formal program for alcoholics at St. Thomas Hospital. As a person completed the program, Sister Ignatia gave a Sacred Heart badge. She basically said to them, and she had a bony finger, if you ever take another drink, you return the Sacred Heart badge to me directly. Actually, she said to them, if you have an urge to take another drink. In 1952, over the protest of her Akron AA friends and supporters, Sister Ignatia was sent by our religious community to St. Vincent Charity Hospital in downtown Cleveland to begin a formal program there. In 1952, she opened a small unit called Rosary Hall Solarium. Why Rosary Hall Solarium? They were the initials of Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, who had died 2 years earlier. This unit has grown and flourishes in accomplishing its mission to this day. Every year there is an AA Mass for Sister Ignatia at the time of the anniversary of her death at St. Patrick's Church in Cleveland. The church is filled with young and old alike. those who knew her, and others who knew of her or heard about her. It is a remarkable witness to her legacy. Sister Teresa Bontempo lived in community and worked at both St. Thomas Hospital and St. Vincent Charity Medical Center with Sister Ignatia. I met Sister Ignatia in 1962 when I began work at St. Vincent Charity as a pharmacy technician as a teenager. I remember very clearly how when she walked through the halls of the hospital, there was always an entourage of people with her. By the time she retired in 1965, I was already in the convent and saw her in chapel in the choir loft praying as we cleaned the chapel. Her death on April 1, 1966, and funeral was at the Cathedral of St. John's in Cleveland, with over 1,500 people in attendance. The Angel of Alcoholics Anonymous was mourned by thousands and thousands of recovering alcoholics and their families. Bill W. wrote a tribute to Sister Ignatia when she died. Ending his tribute, he said, and I quote, "I could think only of her poignant and oft-reported saying, 'Eternity is now.' And so it is, and she is among us today." So in gratitude of the honor you give to her in our religious congregation today, I ask that you pray and remember Sister Ignatia, who had the serenity to accept the things she could not change, change the things she could, and above all, had the wisdom to know the difference. The prayers of the Sisters of Charity of St. Augustine are with all of you each day. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your lives and for this honor. Thank you.
Sister Teresa says you weren't supposed to do that. AA can indeed be thankful and grateful for our non-alcoholic friends. Thank you, Sister Judith. Thank you, Sister Teresa. And now here is Bill to chair the Corps of AA and the AA meeting.
That was a wonderful presentation. We could be filled with gratitude for our non-alcoholic friends. And now for our AA meeting. Let's begin with a moment of silence for the still suffering alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and to help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. Thus, we respectfully ask that no AA speakers and AA members not be photographed, videotaped, or identified by full name on audio tapes and in published or broadcast reports of our meetings, including those reports on the Internet. The assurance of anonymity is essential in our efforts to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program with us. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us that AA principles come before personalities. Out of respect for others, please do not take photographs or videos during any of the meetings at the International Convention. Also, be considerate when taking photographs around convention venues. Take care that you do not capture images of AA members, family members, and friends who do not give permission and may not wish to appear in your pictures, even if you have permission to take photos or videos. Our traditions guide us not to post any content that identifies AA members as such on websites accessible to the public or to share on its publicly accessible social media or social networking platforms, apps, or websites. I have asked Nathan to read a portion of How It Works, Chapter 5 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the very foundation of our AA program of recovery from alcoholism. Before this reading, we ask that you please let Nathan read this portion of the Big Book without interruption or audience participation.
Good morning. My name is Nathan, and I am an alcoholic. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two,
nous en sommes venus à croire qu'une puissance supérieure à nous-mêmes pouvait nous rendre la raison.
Step three,
decidimos poner nuestras voluntades y nuestras vidas al cuidado de Dios, como nosotros lo concebimos.
Step four,
wir machten eine gründliche und furchtlose Inventur in unserem Innern.
Step five.
Визнали перед Богом, перед собою та іншою людиною справжню природу своїх помилок.
Step six.
Kuudes askel. Olimme täysin valmiit antamaan Jumalan poistaa kaikki nämä luonteemme heikkoudet.
Step seven.
私たちの短所を取り除いてくださいと謙虚に神に求めた.
Step 8.
Fizemos uma relação de todas as pessoas que tínhamos prejudicado e nos dispusemos a reparar os danos a elas causados.
Step 9.
Лично возмещали причиненный этим людям ущерб, где только возможно, кроме тех случаев, когда это могло повредить им или кому-либо другому.
Step 10.
Abbiamo continuato a fare l'inventario personale e quando ci siamo trovati in torto lo abbiamo subito ammesso.
Step 11.
Dążyliśmy przez modlitwę i medytację do coraz doskonalszej więzi z Bogiem, jakkolwiek go pojmujemy, prosząc jedynie o poznanie Jego woli wobec nas oraz o siłę do jej spełnienia.
Step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Thank you, Nathan. This morning we have a three-speaker meeting. And to start us off, please welcome Amalia C. from Connecticut.
Good morning. My name is Amalia, and I'm alcoholic. And I'm awfully grateful to be sober, and especially grateful to be sober with all of you today. My sobriety date is January 23rd, 1986. My home group is the Mayflower Group. We meet in West Hartford, Connecticut, on Monday nights. I have a sponsor. I have a service sponsor. And I'm blessed to have sponsees in my life. I was born in El Salvador. I'm the youngest of three daughters of a single mom.
My father was taken away from the house by the police when I was about 5 years old or so because of his drunken behavior. And he went on to become a street drunk. And I was raised by my mother, along with my two older sisters, each one 8 years older than the other. So I grew up like with three moms. And my oldest sister gave me love and nurturing. My middle sister took me to parties. And my mother dispensed discipline and punishment left and right. I grew up to become a very angry, fearful, rageful teenager. I think back to my childhood, and I think fear was the predominant feeling. I think back to my adolescence, and I think fear and anger. I know fear and anger were the only feelings I could recognize. When I was 16, I came to the United States. My sister, my middle sister, had come here a couple of years before. Prior to that, I drank for the first time. I think I was, I don't remember my first drink, but I was about 12, 13 years old at those parties that my mother used to send me out with my sister. When she went out with friends, I was like a little chaperone. And that's where I tasted alcohol, and I knew that there was a reason to live. And I looked forward all the time to the next time that I could drink. So I remember sitting in the plane coming from El Salvador with tears rolling down my cheeks, thinking and saying to myself, I will never, ever come back to this place. And that place that I was never going to come back to, I guess, wasn't El Salvador. It was that place that I brought with me. And I brought it with me, and my alcoholism progressed, and I went from being, a happy-go-lucky kind of drinker. When I was the life of the party, I went to school, I worked, and I was determined to prove my mother wrong, and so because in her rages at times, she would tell me that I would never amount to anything, but I was going to prove her wrong, and I eventually found myself being a sad and lonely woman that had to drink before and after the party. And I found the love of my life in school, in college here. We lived together 39 years. We got a divorce in December. By that time, I had been sober 28 years. And my mother passed away here 4 years ago. My mother gave her a long enough life that I could make amends to her and I could learn to love her for the woman that she was, trying to do the best she could. And I was able to serve her and be with her when she died. Going through my divorce, the only thing I prayed for was that I would have grace and dignity to go through it all and to be able to find forgiveness in my heart. I know today, as I stand here, that the love of my life will always be the love of my life, but I don't have to be with her. I think back while I'm here in this convention with the theme of and the obvious inclusivity of AA that we have. I think back to my early sobriety. The day I went into treatment, another man went into treatment, tall, leather and chains, hair down to his waist, and he became my best friend, my soul friend.
and we used to share. And he was 10 years sober alongside with me. And we used to celebrate our anniversary in my house. My first sponsor was a former nun, and she had a friend who was a nun. And my partner would invite all of them, well, the four of them, to come and celebrate our anniversary. And so there we were, the two lesbians, the two nuns, and the chain and leather motorcycle couple. As I went along in AA, I found out that AA wasn't just in English. And in Connecticut, there was a fledgling Spanish-speaking district, and I was introduced to it. And I hated going to the Spanish meeting at the beginning because I found all the middle-aged men with all the attitudes that I came running away from El Salvador. There they were. And I learned to love them and to serve them. And as I practiced the steps, they all seemed to have gotten better. Today, I go to a service manual meeting at a Spanish-speaking group that meets about 45 minutes away from my house. And I bring some of the people that I know from AA who speak English. And we have a service manual study group. And some speak English and some just speak Spanish, and we speak the language of the heart. And we have a ball. It is amazing. I found AA through CPC. I was put in touch with my doctor, who knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, who put me in touch with an alcohol counselor, who suggested treatment, and God saw it fit that I would find God there. I did not, but when I got to treatment, I knew there was no God. There was absolutely nothing I could depend on except myself. But when I came out of treatment, I had a spiritual experience that I continue to have. There is an opening of communication between myself and this spiritual energy I choose to call God, because it's just the easiest name I have. And I know that we're all a part of it. Everything that lives is a part of it. And I have never been alone since. I have felt a myriad of feelings, but not loneliness. Even going through my divorce and being divorced, I have felt a number of feelings, but certainly not loneliness. And I'm just so grateful. And I look around here, and I think back to a time when I was a teenager walking on the beach of El Salvador with my mother. I was an enraged teenager. And we came upon a fortune teller, and my mother brought me to her. And I thought to myself, she wants the fortune teller to tell her all the dirt about me. And the fortune teller took my hand and said, you're going to travel very far, and you're going to have a very, very large family, and you are going to be well respected. And I said, whatever. And I have come a long, long way in my path. And I have a huge family of treasures. And I have been treated and continue to be treated with dignity and respect ever since I got into AA. And I feel it my responsibility to pass along that dignity and respect to those that are coming and that are yet to come, and especially to my sisters
to my Latin American Spanish-speaking sisters, alcoholic sisters that are yet to come. It is all of our responsibilities to see to it that we treat each other with dignity, and especially the newcomer. And I'm speaking to my Latin American Spanish-speaking siblings, men and women, regardless of what culture myths we grew up in, we owe it to ourselves to pass along the dignity of and respect that Alcoholics Anonymous gives us. I have been blessed beyond belief with service opportunity. I was a couple months sober, I think, and I was going to meetings. I was working my program. I had a sponsor. Work was fine. My partner and I were working on our relationship. I didn't feel like drinking, but I felt a void and a certain feeling of, is that all there is? And I got scared. So I made an appointment to go see my old counselor in treatment. She told me that I was still mourning alcohol and that I needed to become active in AA. She suggested I go to my home group and ask if there was any service for me to do. So I started making coffee. And they let me make coffee. And I started meeting people before and after. And then I was less than 2 years sober, and they allowed me to become the alternate GSR. The group conscience decided that they would let me do that. And the GSR decided that he couldn't finish his term. And so I became the GSR. And I've had service opportunity in AA all throughout, and I don't have a void in my heart. And I know that Alcoholics Anonymous has no barriers. The doors are wide, and we all fit. And so it's my duty and my privilege and my freedom and my honor to be there ready to go to any length, not necessarily for my own sobriety, but for those yet to come. So I am awfully, awfully grateful to be here with you today. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Amalia. Our second speaker is Jason S. from Georgia.
Hi, I'm Jason. I'm an alcoholic. In all my years of drinking, I was able to experience many different situations. But today, I must say, is the greatest of them all. When I woke up this morning, I was an inmate firefighter at Walker Faith and Character Based Prison. And God willing, when I lay my head down tonight, I will be at Walker Faith and Character Based Prison. But for today, I'm being able to share how I become happy, joyous, and free. I can't really blame the way I was brought up on the way that I turned out. Because other than when my father left for about a month or so, I had nothing but pleasant memories as a child. There was three of us. I had an older brother, my sister, and I. Our parents were very warm and loving people who wanted nothing more but to bring their kids up in a loving, respectable home. I would say as a child that I was a shy, timid, somewhat of a mother's boy. Having an older brother allowed me to be able to hang out with an older crew, and at that point, I began to feel a little out of place. At the age of 11, I was introduced to alcohol. And when I took that first drink, I realized it made me feel like I'd fit in, that I was a lot more outspoken. I knew from that point forward, if the opportunity ever presented itself, I would drink again. At the age of 16, I'd gotten a part-time job, and the only real responsibility I had was to pay half of my car insurance. So I did what I thought normal teenage boys do, and I spent my weekends drinking and partying. At the age of 17, I'd become really rebellious against my father. After months of fighting, I dropped out of high school and become employed with the company that he'd worked for. I found out in the construction business that there were so many others just like me. And it didn't take long for me to realize that with my father being my boss, that if I laid out of work, he would cover for me. At the age of 18, I fell in love not only with a female, but also with a lifestyle. I told myself that I would soon outgrow it, but that day never did come. At the age of 20, we had two twin daughters, and followed a year later by their younger sister. It was about the time the twins were 3 years old that I found out they biologically was not my children. And man, did this hurt me on the inside. I told myself that I would forgive, but I was soon to find out that I would never forget. In the years that passed, I began to be filled with anger and rage, and I always feared that my children would grow up not to respect me, not being their father. As I got to feeling like this, there would be arguments around the house, and I would leave and go on binges for 3, 4, 5 days at a time. I would lay out of work. I'd put my father's job at risk. And then when I'd come home, my house would be nothing but violence and arguments. I never realized what I was bringing my kids through. And then in 2008, between 2008 and 2009, I had a series of events that at one time I would have considered calamities, but today I consider them necessities. In June of 2008, my brother and I were spending the Sunday together, and before the day was over, me and him had a big falling out. Usually when my brother and I had a falling out, it would only last 2 or 3 weeks and everything would go back to normal. But this one was a much different situation. In the week that followed, I woke up one morning to go to work and the phone was ringing. And when I answered the phone, it was my brother's brother-in-law telling me that my brother had passed away. I was never able to tell my brother that I was sorry. About 3 months later, Tanya had decided that she was fed up with living with me, and she left too. So here I am sitting around, and I'm pondering the loss of my brother, the loss of my family, and I'm watching my mama battle brain cancer. Well, in November, I go to court, and I'm granted temporary custody of my biological daughter. In the weeks that followed, I told myself that I would go out and celebrate. So I took one weekend, and I went out, and I partied all weekend long, a lot of intense drinking, and very little sleep. On that Monday morning, I decided that I was in no condition to go to work, so I called in once again. Sometime around lunchtime that day, it hit me that I should go home and be a father to the daughter that I was battling for in court. So I get ready to leave. I go to the gas station. I go to get some money out of the ATM, get some gas, and I buy a beer. The next day I wake up, I'm in Grady Memorial Hospital to find out that I'd been charged with vehicular homicide and DUI. My father came and bonded me out that following Wednesday. I went home and I told myself that I'd never really wanted to drink again. I laid on the couch. I soaked in self-pity, just thinking about the life that I had taken from another individual. Within the week that followed, I noticed that my habits were slowly progressing right back to the same way they was. I was just justifying it because I wasn't drinking while I was driving. Come December, I was locked up one more time, and I was at the county jail. And at the county jail, you're not allowed to have any contact visits. So I'd been there about a month, and my dad brings my mom in to see me, and he pushes her in her wheelchair, and I pick up the phone, and I'm talking to my mom through the glass. And all I could really think about was this was going to be the last time I'd ever see my mom alive. All I really wanted to do was hug her neck. In the May that followed, my mom passed away, and I was unable to attend the funeral. So I go to court, and I'm given a 15-year sentence, 10 of which I'm to serve in prison. I finally make it to the prison, and I thought back in times that when I had really felt out of place, this was a place that had really made me feel out of place. So I catch myself in prison, and I'm still using at my first institution whenever the opportunity presents itself. In 2011, I'm shipped to Jackson County Correctional Institute, where my life would slowly take a change. In August of 2011, I was able to join the inmate fire department. And it was when I joined the inmate fire department that I found something that I truly love and enjoy doing once again. I caught myself sitting on my bunk at nights, wondering what life would be like if I never took another drink. But then I sat and also thought about, for 31 years, I still had never figured out how to not pick up that first drink. Well, being a fireman in a situation in a prison, you're around the gentleman you're with on the fire department 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Well, I started bonding pretty close with the gentleman, and he seemed pretty sure about his recovery. The more we talked, the more he talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. So, the meetings were held on Thursday nights. And so, one Thursday, I took the initiative to attend. And I never will forget my very first meeting. We do our readings. And not long after we get finished with our readings, Roy and Jim walk in. And by looking at the gentleman, they were completely different in every aspect of life. I think that's what made my meeting, my very first meeting, so perfect. As Roy began to speak, there was a lot of similarities to his story and mine. Roy had been a lot like I was as a child, but what really fascinated me about his story is that he had been in prison too. The most fascinating part about his story was that he had been sober about as long as that I had been alive. And then Jim shared his story, and Jim had never been to prison, just a couple of stints in the county jail for a DUI. But he said so many things that made sense. And when I made it back to my dorm that night, all I could really think about was Roy's story and how much hope I now had that I could one day be sober. I continued to go to the meetings, and week after week, these gentlemen showed with joy. I never will forget the first Thanksgiving after I started attending meetings. After the 6:30 count, the officers would come and let us know it was time for a meeting. But on this Thanksgiving, the sergeant on shift said there wouldn't be no meeting because it was Thanksgiving. We argued with the officer for a second, and he finally let us out of the dorm. And to his disbelief, these two gentlemen showed up. It was at this time that I had felt a love like I hadn't felt in such a long time. Here I was at my bottom. And these two men took time away from their families to come in and share a message with somebody like me. At Jackson County, the way the Georgia Department of Corrections work, the volunteers there couldn't really have no more interaction with you other than just carrying the meeting. So it was at these meetings that I was able to gain a lot of knowledge about the Alcoholics Anonymous program. But there was still so much more that I was missing. In August of last year, I was shipped to Walker Faith and Character-Based Prison, which has truly turned out to be a blessing in my life. I've been able to obtain my MPQ-1 and MPQ-2 firefighter certifications, but most of all, I've finally been given the opportunity to work the steps. Jim is now my sponsor, and for that I am forever grateful. These two men hold a great place in my heart. I can remember, and when I first started my sentence, that how much I hated the system for not letting me, go to my mom's funeral. I hated myself for not being there for my mom. I hated myself for taking the life of another man. Not only had I pulled a father away from my children, but this man would never be allowed to see his children again. And for a long time, it's really built up in me, and I had no way to get it off. But today, I can say that I'm grateful for my prison experience, because I've realized now that I was bound in chains long before I ever come to prison. Today I look forward to waking up day after day and seeing what God has in store for my life. I'm no longer ashamed of who I am or what I've become. I found a freedom even in my bottoms. I feel like that there's no farther lower that I could go, but I've watched God slowly restore so many things. My relationship with my children are probably better now than they have ever been. The relationship with my father is greater now than it's ever been. And it's in prison where I've truly found joy. I found the firefighters program, I found AA, and I found sobriety. Today marks my official fourth year of sobriety. I would just like to take this time to thank Roy and Jim for stepping inside a correctional facility to bring the message to a lost soul like myself. But I would also like to thank Warden Lee and the staff and everyone at Walker Faith and Character Based Prison who has made this dream a reality for me here today. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Jason. Finally, I will introduce our third speaker this morning, Trish N. from British Columbia.
Hi, friends. Hola, amigos. Bonjour, mes amis. My name is Trish, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you so much for the loving invitation to participate today. And thank you for the honor and the privilege of sharing the stage with Amalia and with Jason. Thank you to everyone throughout the weekend for sharing your stories and your inspiration, and especially just being you. You know, my higher power works through other people. I'm kind of earthy that way sometimes. And I have to tell you, right now, I have a huge higher power, thanks to all of you. My sobriety date is February 19th, 1994. To you. My home group is the Reflections Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, eh? And there's a chair waiting for you there, but, you know, don't come all at once this year. Come to Detroit in 2020, but then in 2025, come and see me in Vancouver. The theme of this incredible 80th birthday celebration is happy, joyous, and free. And I have to tell you, to qualify here, those were words that I didn't know when I finally hit my bottom. I like to say sometimes that I got sober when I was supposed to, not necessarily when I wanted to. And the thing is, you know, by the end of my drinking story is incredibly boring. By the end of my drinking, there was no fun left in it. I basically got up in the morning feeling pretty darned ill. I went to work so I could earn the money to buy the booze. I stopped at the jar store on the way home. I went home and I drank until I passed out. And if I was lucky, if I was really lucky, I passed out before all the booze was gone. Right? No, that's backwards. Anyway, if I was really lucky, I passed out in time. But if I drank all the booze and I hadn't passed out yet, then I got in the car and I got some more. Because that's what I did as an alcoholic. That's what I did. And it was just a life of desperation and just boring. Nothing social about it. I got to tell you, though, my family, I come from a military family, actually. My father was a member of the Royal Canadian Navy. My uncle was a member of the Canadian Army. My aunts were Air Force. My grandfather was Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And we moved a lot. All the family moved a lot. And the thing, I didn't really know the other members of the family when I was growing up. And at one point, and this is where I say I got sober when I was supposed to, not when I wanted to. When I was 20 years old, at this point, my family had actually settled, and I know there are some of you here. When my dad left the Navy, we settled in small town Ontario, a little town called Midland. Okay. And it was a lovely small town, but we had stopped moving, but my grandmother was actually in Vancouver. So I went out to visit my grandmother when I was 20, and I hadn't really met her before. I'd maybe seen her as a kid, but I'd never had the chance to experience my grandmother. And I was just kind of blown away. My grandmother was from Grand Falls, Newfoundland. Yes. And she chain-smoked Cravenet cigarettes, and she drank the world's most awful tea. It was so strong you could stand a spoon up in it. And she told these great stories. And I just was charmed by her. I just loved her to pieces. And what I didn't know then, and what I know now, is that my grandmother was an alcoholic. And my grandmother tried to sober up before there was an Alcoholics Anonymous. My grandmother tried to sober up in the 1920s in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And she tried to sober up through the Oxford Group. And when I hear our AA history, I think about my grandmother, and it's personal. And it wasn't successful for my grandmother. And I can only imagine, it breaks my heart when I think about my grandmother struggling with this disease with no solution. And I think about the stigma that women faced at that point. And I know how lucky I am today that there is a solution. And I know how I felt as a woman coming into AA, and I felt that stigma, but not the stigma that my grandmother felt. And I owe AA, and I owe my grandmother. My grandmother spoke to me in what I now know to be the language of the heart. So when the time came for me to recognize that I could, because my grandmother was 7 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous when she died on my 21st birthday. Thank you. I am so grateful to all of you. I am so grateful. I believe that, you know, I had every alcoholic tendency when I was growing up. It was just waiting for the booze to kick in. I was an only child. I kind of liked it. I was the center of attention. I figured I was pretty smart. I was pretty precocious. And all that moving meant that I just didn't like people very much, and I really had trouble fitting in. I adored my dad. I made my mom the enemy. And you know, that was the way it went. In Midland, I went to high school there for a few years, but then I met the boy of my dreams. We ran away, we lived together, we got married, and I divorced him later, and that man is George I, the first ex-husband. I moved to Vancouver in 1978 to have the job of my dreams. I had arrived, like it said in the big book. I left Midland behind, I left Ontario behind, I had gone through university in Toronto, I wanted this career, and I had this great job. And it was closer to my family. My grandmother had died, but my aunt was still there. So there I was, and it was amazing for me. But I began at this point to notice that I drank a little differently than other people. So my work involved numbers of receptions and things like that, and I learned that I had to be careful. I had to be more controlled. I couldn't drink the way I wanted to drink, the way I drank with my dad. I had to just have a couple of glasses at the reception. And then what I did was I threw the party back at my place afterwards so I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And that worked for a while. And at this point, I met another man of my dreams and married him. I used to skip dating and just go straight to marriage. And this man became Paul II, the second ex-husband. And the thing was that Paul was actually the victim, in a sense, of the progression of my disease. And I didn't want him to know how much I was drinking. And I was trying to control it. I was trying to control it for him. I was trying to control it for work. It never occurred to me to quit. But the thing was, I had to control it. So what I'd do is if we were having dinner and there was wine at dinner, there usually was, because I wanted wine at dinner, I knew it wouldn't be enough. So I kept vodka in the bathroom under the cabinet. And I'd just get up from the table and I'd go and I'd drink vodka and come back and hopefully, you know, get to where I wanted to get. There's a problem with this, a very alcoholic problem. Swigging vodka is not a precise science. Getting to the sweet spot of being just buzzed enough without being incoherently, blindly drunk was missed 90% of the time. And Paul eventually went sailing around the world without me, because that's what he needed to do to stay safe for me, and I got that. But that gave me license to drink, and drink I did. At one point, I did call Alcoholics Anonymous in Vancouver, our intergroup office. The two wonderful people came and took me to my first meeting, but I didn't stick around. I did what alcoholics like me do. I drank. I stuck around. I stayed dry. I hated the steps. I hated you. It wasn't going to work for me. Thank you very much. So I said, I prefer the blackness. And I just went at it again. And I'm so grateful that I didn't have to go at it for all that long. And I'm so grateful that I hit my bottom when I did, and a series of miracles, which for me is higher power at work through you and through the work that you do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they started to happen. Honestly, I was working on an event. At this point, I'm a freelancer. You know, my career is kind of it's a little shreddy. My health is deteriorating. My mind is a mess. But I'm still working because I still have to buy that booze. And so I was working on a project, and I was arrested for impaired driving at 9:30 in the morning in the parking lot of our convention center in Vancouver, BC, Canada. And here's the miracle, though. The arresting officer, instead of throwing me in the drunk tank, turned me over to victim services. And I was stunned, because I knew I deserved to be in the drunk tank. And someone had done an amazing job of cooperation with the professional community for that man to realize that I couldn't cope, that I was a victim. And I thank him from the bottom of my heart, and I thank you. And I know it made me possible to think differently about myself. He saw hope where I saw none. And so when I was being fingerprinted that same day for that impaired charge, and when the question got asked, and I sure hope they still ask it in Vancouver, the question was asked, "Are you an alcoholic?" I said, "Yes," and I got step one finally. And I knew where I had to come back to, and thank you for taking me back. I came back and I did everything as differently as I could. I was determined that I would do this in the spirit in which you had told me before, but which I hadn't listened. And I sobered up in February. In March, my mom came out for a visit, my mom the enemy, without my dad. My parents used to come out and spend time in the winter to break up the winter months. And she said, "Trish, your dad's too sick. I'm going to come on my own." So she came out for a visit. And I booked a flight back home in May. And I don't remember much of that visit because I was pretty newly sober, but I knew I wanted to see Dad. And just before I was supposed to go, in the second week of May, my mom called in the first week of May and said, "Trish, you have to come now. Your dad's sicker. We don't know what's going on." And I adored my dad. I told you that. I adored him. And I thought, okay, but because of you and because I got sober when I was supposed to, not necessarily when I wanted to, I could undo that flight, and I could redo it to a new flight, and I could get on that plane, and I didn't have to drink and fly, which I love to do, believe me. But God was on one shoulder, and my father was on the other, and I landed in Toronto, and a cousin came and picked me up and took me to my parents' home. And my mom and I went to the hospital, and I got to tell my dad that I love him. And I got to tell him I was going to look after my mom, and he died 20 minutes after I got there, thanks to you. My dad was an alcoholic. He had three brothers and sisters. Two of them were alcoholic, and the third just kept marrying them. Yeah. But the thing is that his death was my gift of life. I knew at that point that his dying meant that I had to stay sober. I needed to stay sober, and I wanted to stay sober. And in fact, his brother, my Uncle George, who sobered up in 1962, God bless him, came to our house. He was living in Ottawa at that point. He was an active member of AA. Uncle George was the army dude. And wherever Uncle George went, there was a big book and a coffee pot. And I didn't know that then, but I know it now, and he told me that day. And so our military folks who carry the message in under all conditions are amazing people. Amazing people. And Uncle George gave me a big old AA hug. It came bounding up my parents' stairs. He gave me a big old AA hug, and he said, "Trish," he said, "your dad died." And I said, "Yeah, he did, Uncle George." And he said, "How long have you been sober now, Trish?" And I said, "Well, it was February 19th, and this is May 8th, Uncle George." And he said, "And you didn't drink today, did you?" And I said, "No, I didn't, Uncle George." And he said, "And you didn't have to, did you?" And I said, "No, I didn't, Uncle George." And he said, "And you don't have to ever again. And you know what, Trish? You don't have to do it alone. AA's here for you." And I believed him. And that was an amazing gift. And I was really hoping I could come back and go to meetings with my Uncle George in Ottawa, but he passed away before that could happen. But I met every member of his Ottawa home group because they were at his funeral. And thank you for being there. And thank you from our family. You know, I have a life that is rich beyond compare thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so grateful to it. And again, it's because people have done work before me. I became a general service. I was active in my group. I joined a home group. It's the same home group. I've had the same home group from the get-go. And I have to tell you today as well, it's Jason's four-year anniversary. It would have been my father's birthday today. And there's another gift. I got active in my home group. They allowed me that gift. They elected me GSR. I got really active in service. It saved my butt. My mom got sick. She was sick with alcoholism. I had the solution for her. My Al-Anon friends in Parksville, BC, where she moved to, took me under their wing and told me what I needed to do. And thank you. You saved my life. And AA has been there for me all the way along. And there were hospital meetings that I took my mom to because somebody on a hospital committee got busy and had a meeting in the Nanaimo General Hospital when we needed one. My mother was treated with incredible care and love and respect at the hospital and detoxed medically because, again, cooperation with the professional community had been at work in our lives. So there it was for her, and she could hear from a professional what she couldn't hear from me about her problem with alcohol. And I don't think she drank. Again, I don't know, it doesn't matter, but I do know that AA was there for us. When I was about 5 years sober, I got to go to India with an organization I was on the board of, and it was amazing. I was the furthest away from home that I had ever been, and I was the longest away from meetings that I had ever been. We were going into tiny, remote villages through the north in Rajasthan. And I didn't have an I saw the effects of alcoholism. I didn't have a chance to really do anything. But when I was in New Delhi, I thought, I've got to get to a meeting. So using the international directory, I connected. And I actually got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, but not the way I thought I was going to. I called the number that we found, and it had been changed a couple of times. So I finally got someone on the phone, and this voice in English said, you know, hello, how can I help you? And I tried to explain, and I wasn't doing very well. And he said, what do you need? And I said, I'm looking for a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, ah, you want my father. One moment. And another voice got on the phone, and it wasn't quite as clear, but he was so excited to hear about this visitor from Canada, and he was talking really quickly, and he was telling me how I could get on the bus, it would be 2 hours to the Delhi Psychiatric Hospital, and then I could come back, and I could go over here, and I'm saying, I don't think this is going to work, but thank you. And he said, oh no, we're going to get you there. You need a meeting. I can tell. You need a meeting. So he said, wait a second, and he put the first voice back on the phone because he was busy that night. He couldn't go. And the first voice said, hello, my name's Sameet. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I will take you to the meeting my father is talking about. So I left a note on my pillow for my roommate saying, I am going with a complete stranger to the Delhi Psychiatric Hospital. See you later. We drove all the way across Delhi to the psychiatric hospital. The meeting had been that morning. There was no meeting. But Sameet said to me, my father said, if there was a problem, I should take you to our home, and we'll wait for him there, and then the two of you can have a meeting. And we did that. We drove all the way back across. And when we got to their beautiful home, I met Mr. G, and he had been in the Indian Air Force, and the message was carried to him by an American Air Force personnel person. And again, and so we opened up the big book, and we had a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Mr. G talked about his higher power, Krishna, and I talked about my higher power, God. And I can tell you, this is a spiritual, spiritual program, not a religious program. I am so grateful to you all. I got to be the delegate for British Columbia and the Yukon Area 79 in 2007 and 2008. And the growth that you've afforded me to learn not just our steps, but our traditions and our concepts has been amazing. It's allowed me to be a good daughter. It's allowed me to be there when my mom died. And the thing is, you know, our steps are distilled into two words, according to Dr. Bob, love and service. And you know, on the AA campus, there are these two people who collided into each other, me and Arnie. And I wouldn't be here today without that sober alcoholic. And for me, he also embodies love and service. Thank you so much for my sobriety. Thank you. Merci. Gracias. God bless.
Thank you, Trish, for sharing with us. This weekend, thousands of us have shared in this wonderful celebration of our great AA fellowship, with people speaking the language of the heart all over this beautiful city. It's impossible to thank all of those involved in making this convention a success. But it certainly couldn't have happened without the assistance of the wonderful local AA host volunteers and the Al-Anon volunteers, too. Nearly 4,000 volunteers spent countless hours getting ready to welcome us. They have done it so graciously and so well. Let's ask all the host committee volunteers present in the stadium this morning to please stand and be recognized as we give them a big hand. Now I would like to ask you to welcome three remarkable members whose hard work and dedication have been a great power of example to all the volunteers. Patty L. Tom H. and Jim T., the co-chairs of the 2015 Atlanta Volunteer Host Committee. Let's give them a big hand. Patty, would you please say a few words?
Hello and good morning. My name is Patty and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Patty.
It is a great morning indeed. I am honored to serve with Jim and Tom as the chair and co-chairs of the Volunteer Host Committee of the 2015 International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are overjoyed and filled with gratitude, and I know that because the three of us have had tears in our eyes all morning long as we sat through the program. We are so happy that you're all here to celebrate with us AA's 80th anniversary. And how about those volunteers? Weren't they awesome? I I'd like to add to the number that Bill reported, because we were close to 4,000 when we started this convention. We added almost another 1,000 during the convention. Our team of volunteers represented 33 countries. Our host committee, along with our friends from Al-Anon, planned for about a year for your arrival. So we were very excited when you finally came. As a result of that planning, everywhere I went this weekend, and I hope everywhere that you went, there was a volunteer in a green shirt that was answering a question, giving directions, shaking a hand, giving a hug, or offering a smile. And they were everywhere. Thank you to all of our volunteers. They did a fantastic job extending our southern hospitality. Thank you.
Thank you, Patty, Tom, and Jim, our three speakers. Once again, let's give them a big round of applause. In closing, I would like to read an excerpt from Chapter 2 in the Big Book, which was first published in 1935. We of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were just as once as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. We are average Americans. All sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, and social and religious backgrounds. We are people who normally would not mix. But there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like passengers of a great liner, and the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel, from steerage to captain's table. Unlike the feeling of the ship's passengers, however, our joy in escape does not subside as we go our separate ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. Please help me close this meeting with the responsibility declaration. I am responsible when anyone, anywhere reaches out for help. I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I am responsible. This concludes AA's 80th Anniversary International Convention. But before you go, would you like to know where we will be in 2020?
On behalf of the Detroit Metro Convention and Business Bureau and our entire hospitality community, thank you for choosing our city to host the 2020 International Convention of AA. We've been looking forward to hosting your convention for years, and our community is gearing up to provide you with a very memorable experience. You may be hearing the talk these days about the exciting transformation taking place in Detroit. There's good reason why the world now refers to the D as the comeback city. Unprecedented levels of new private investment is fueling dramatic change in downtown. From a revitalized convention center and sparkling international waterfront to new hotels, restaurants, attractions, and light rail, the Motor City is on the move, and our future is bright. I hope you have a very productive and successful meeting this year, and know that we are prepared to give you our very best in 2020. We talked to visitors all over the world who visited our great city, and here is what they had to say.
For me, the first thing that comes to my mind when I hear of Detroit is the rich culture of auto manufacturing. I mean, this city gave birth to a lot of good companies.
This is a great city, and you guys have been awesome hosts.
This is absolutely beautiful, and I'm glad that they did the Congress here this year. A lot of people, definitely big enough. It's a beautiful building, all the floors, all the rooms. It's amazing. It's great.
People are moving here from Silicon Valley because now Detroit's the cool place to be.
Welcome to Detroit, America's great comeback city.